The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Infracell up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, and this is the Let's Voltron podcast, the official Voltron podcast, and I'm here with Mike French. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Doing great. So do we have anything going on at World Events Productions or anything new coming up with Voltron?
I can tell you that we have this month the second issue of Dynamite Comics' Robotech Voltron series. Of course, the cover art's drawn by Tommy Yoon. It's a beautiful issue. I've had the pleasure of reading it. It's awesome. It's really compelling, and I can't wait for it to come out. I don't know the exact street date, but it's this month, and I think Voltron fans are going to be really excited. It's a really exciting story.
I know we got a tease of that issue 3 cover, didn't we?
Yes, with Max getting backed up by the Black Lion, looking like he's got some very interesting Veritech mods on him. So I can't wait to see the contents of that issue as well. It looks like a very cool mashup series.
I know. It was great when we were talking with George Sohn last episode, and we were talking about the possibility that there would be a really cool Robotech Voltron crossover. That would be awesome if that would ever happen, wouldn't it?
I would love to see some toys like that. I'm guiltily admitting and confessing that I would love to see Robotech Voltron Lion crossover toys. Yes.
All right. So we have a very special announcement to make. Of course, the last episode we did the Challenge the Chi. We have decided. There's been a number of entries out there, but. It was up to us to decide which one we were going to pick. So we decided Cryoflight picked the best one because based on the fact that there were a lot of things that happened in the Voltron universe, Cryoflight had mentioned something that hasn't happened, and it was something that we would like to see. So what Cryoflight said was the space explorers taking on that robe beast they never got to fight in the arena. What do you think about that one, Mike?
That's pretty cool because that works in both ways. I mean, we never got to see them fight that robe beast in Voltron, and in the original Beast King Go Lion, they talk about it in the past tense, where they were one of the only surviving groups of slaves to have successfully beaten back that robe beast in the arena to live another day. So we never got to see them fight it in Go Lion, and we never got to see them fight it in Voltron. I would love to see a depiction of that.
Yeah, that was that blue robe beast with the lizard head and long tongue and the Stretch Armstrong body. Yeah. So I think it would be great if Chitoy could make us a really nice picture depicting the space explorers fighting that blue robe beast. So there you go, Chitoy. Let's see what you do. And you'll be seeing that image when Chitoy is done with it out on the Let's Voltron Facebook page. That inspired us for what we really wanted to do this week. So we haven't really gotten into talking about any of the episodes yet, have we, Mike?
No, we haven't. But, you know, it's always good to talk about Voltron episodes. I don't care what you're doing.
Right. So being that this is the 30th anniversary of when Voltron started back in 1984, we decided we're going to start at the very beginning of the Lion Force series at Space Explorers Captured and start this story from the beginning. And today's podcast episode, we are going to stop right before Voltron is formed in that fourth episode, you know, just to give a little tease.
I think that's fair.
Let's talk about Space Explorers Captured.
All right. You want to get started? You want me to start?
You have the perspectives, just so everybody knows. You have the perspective of the original Beast Go Lion.
Right.
Whereas I don't. I have the original episode of Voltron, and that's it.
And that is more than enough, I'll tell you that much. But I can certainly throw in the comparatives to Beast King Go Lion, how things were different. In the small ways, I should say that there are a few major ways that they were different, and I'll make sure to chime in when they are. But certainly, Voltron is the phenomenon, and it's the one we all remember. So I say we start from that front.
Right. So it all starts with Air Unit Leader Keith and Hunk, both in their spacesuits for some reason.
Yes, they are oddly pulled from Vehicle Voltron. You're actually looking at Lunk and Jeff in that scene, and they
Right.
act, and it's interesting too because they're called Air Unit, which is
Yes.
funny. I'm like, wait, does that mean that they have their own like Air Unit, like the Voltron Vehicle Voltron team does, or no, wait, nope.
Yeah. So they're basically patrolling, and they see that there's a whole lot of activity going on at Planet Eris, and they think it must be that fiendish old space pirate King Zarkon, right?
Yeah, that they go through an asteroid storm of some kind, and they see the devastation and the destruction that's taken place on Eris, and they're shocked and appalled.
When they get to the close-ups of what's happening on planet Eris, you got to realize that these guys are way out in space at this point. Okay, so how is it that they can see these close-ups of what's happening on planet Eris? Well, Sven explains it. He says, "It looks pretty bad through the telescanners."
That's actually a really good impression. How long have you been working on
Oh, you
that?
know, Michael Bell would probably hit me.
It's interesting when you watch that montage as they look through the telescanner. You see these buildings and this awful destruction and these cityscapes that look nothing like any of the architecture that you actually end up seeing on planet Eris in its ruins. And this kind of brings up the first big point, the big change between Golion and Voltron, for anybody who's interested, who's listening, is that in Golion, the space explorers are actually headed back to Earth when they find out, much to their surprise, that Earth has destroyed itself in a nuclear war. And they're looking at the devastation of Earth. And there's a lot of other shots in there that are cut out of Voltron. And so what you're so that's why there's this kind of disconnect between some of the buildings and architecture that you see that's allegedly the destroyed planet Eris, because you're actually looking at the destroyed cityscapes of New York and London and Tokyo and things like that.
And Keith, when he first sees the devastation, he says the streets are empty. It looks like everyone made it to their underground shelters. And that's basically how they explain it away, you know?
Right,
There's
right.
nobody getting killed here.
Right. And of course, that was the 80s. Now they might be a little more edgy with it. But yes, at that time they had to find a way to explain it away, or else there wouldn't have been a show.
Yeah, and so the next time you see the whole unit of the space explorers, you see Hunk and Sven and Pidge and Lance and Keith, and they're all in street clothes, of course, now.
Right, they're in the cockpit of the ship trying to assess the devastation.
Right, and they realize at this point that they're too late to help anybody. The only thing that they can do is help the people of Eris rebuild. And at that point, they run into one of Zarkon's attack ships that stayed behind to mop up.
Right, and then they're much like the ship in the beginning of Star Wars. They're pulled into the tractor beam and
Right.
they're taken prisoner. Now in Golion, they are it's there's a twist to this. In Golion, they're surveying their own home world, and Zarkon Dibazol, as he's called in Golion, is actually orbiting that planet because he heard about the war and the destruction, and he's going there to see if he can find survivors to take in as slaves for his gladiatorial games. And that's when he sees their ship coming into orbit over the planet, and that's why he captures them. So he's looking to Earth for the spoils. He didn't actually cause the war, but he will certainly take advantage of the leftovers.
All right. Did you ever see the Blue Volume number one of Media Blasters DVD set?
I have it. I have it right here.
All right. The first time that we go to the Galaxy Garrison, I swear I saw that Garrison was spelled Garrison in the subtext. Now, I don't know, I go back to this and I see it, and then I go back to the Legend Begins DVD set, which doesn't have it. It's spelled correctly there. And then all the digital versions like Netflix and YouTube and everything, I see it's spelled correctly. So I was just wondering if anybody else had noticed that.
I haven't noticed that, but I don't doubt it for a minute. I need to go back and look at it. What I can tell you is that, as you've probably seen from the documentaries that are on that first set about the gargantuan task that World Events had trying to recreate the show from scratch, not from scratch, but they realized that the broadcast masters were not up to the quality necessary to produce a DVD. And so they had to re-edit the show from Beast King Go Lion's scanned negatives. And when they did that, I can only imagine what the scope of that job was.
Right.
Because they had to comb through all sorts of footage and recreate fonts. And it was just a massive amount of work. And right. one of the readers told me recently that some of the shots within the remastered Voltron also are transposed or different from things they have in their old 1980s VHS tapes. Just subtle things that no one could have possibly picked up on. But I'm sure that typo in the subtitle is one of those things they caught instantly. Couldn't catch it fast enough for the author discs, but right. They caught it fast enough to make sure that it was correct online and then correct on the next pressing, which is The Legend Begins.
Right. So at this point, the five space explorers, you know, are sort of trapped. They're on a prison ship headed towards Planet Doom, and the Galaxy Garrison. All right, when we see them for the first time, you know, it's based on the whole idea of the Galaxy Alliance, right? And
right.
If they're to be any help to the space explorers, you would think that they would just want to just go right out and try to rescue them. I mean, they even mention it. They're on their own now. Should we rescue them? And it's 2,000 light years away. Their best chance is to try to escape. You know, they're trained for survival and everything. So, you know, it just seems to me that what is this Galaxy Alliance for if they can't help five space explorers?
You know, I picked up on that. I rewatched this this series of episodes right before we had our podcast, and I wanted to kind of brush up. The one thing that did strike me about that scene is that, you know, Zarkon, his forces are immense. And speaking just not just as a fan, but just from a place of, not to sound like Spock, but from a place of logic, if I was to calculate the odds at that Galaxy Garrison command table, I would sit there and say, okay, if they're alive, they're going to have to settle on their own resources, because the amount of lives and equipment it would take to go in there and try to extract them from Planet Doom would probably devastate our entire fleet. It's kind of like when they were weighing the options in World War II of like, okay, do we invade Japan from the ground, or do we, you know, use, you know, the Enola Gay? It's like, well, right. You know, the amount of lives we're going to lose here, it could be incalculable. So I think in that instance, yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like, oh, what, you're not going to save the heroes of the show? But at the same time, it's like, well, they have other priorities. So,
and the whole thing about it is you know, it was Planet Eris that got attacked, and Planet Eris is obviously light years away from Planet Earth at this point. So they can't even verify that this attack has happened, and Zarkon's ambassadors, of course, are saying, hey, we didn't attack Eris.
Right.
So it sort of reminds me of what had happened in episode one of Star Wars in The Phantom Menace.
Uh-huh.
When
I try and forget that movie whenever possible, but go ahead.
I know when they had put a blockade on Naboo, and you know there was no way for Coruscant to verify that this had actually happened.
Right. And that also starts to create some narrative issues if you think too hard on it, which we'll get to later as we unfold some of these other episodes, but. Yeah, that compression of time between the Galaxy Garrison figuring out that the space explorers have been captured and that lack of information, that vacuum that's been created, it's pretty impressive how fast Zarkon is able to engineer that whole thing.
Right. And so we follow the prison ship to Planet Doom, and we see Urak for the first time, Commander Urak.
Uh-huh.
He hasn't been officially identified yet. He's speaking, and he says, "You miserable fools, escape is impossible," and uses whips on prisoners and things like that. And I'm not really sure why his right eye is like a red monocle, but you know, they're preparing a special place in the castle dungeons for the five space explorers.
Yes, and that's another little deviation. You know, in Voltron, the space explorers, their importance is heightened based on the dialogue that is spoken by Zarkon and by Urak. In Goliath, they're just in with the rest of the populace. They're just five nameless aliens from a dead world, and they're on their own. There's no galaxy garrison to help them. They know their world is dead, and they know that if they don't survive or continue to win at the games, they'll just be churned up into dog food for the Robeasts.
Right.
So
now, at this point, it goes into a commercial, and you have that Voltron will be right back, and now back to Voltron, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say, this was something that they had talked about with the music and with the pace of the show and everything. I think they did a great job whenever they went off to a commercial and came back and everything, and especially in this first episode, it was so important. You're building up to seeing the villain. And the villain, of course, is King Zarkon. You don't see him within the first commercial break, within
right.
that first part. You see all the events that build up to this, and now we come back from the commercial break, and we are at Planet Doom. We're seeing Castle Doom for the first time, and now here it is with Zarkon, and he's explaining, "Planet Eris is now defeated, and I, Zarkon, rule the entire universe. And with the capture of the space explorers, I need no longer fear the Galaxy Alliance." And so the Galaxy Alliance, you know, they must have done something to make him fear them or something. But apparently these five space explorers were all they had. So once he gets them, he's got them. He's got the Galaxy Alliance now.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe he's like the... Maybe he's like the former president of Iran who thought that when he captured some hikers on his border, he had the United States, you know, on its knees. And I don't know, not to get political at all. It's just that sometimes dictators throughout history, they think that small victories, or what they see in their mind as small victories, are actually massive, you know, ultimatums that they've now achieved. And that's always kind of what strikes me about the writing in Voltron, is that I think – you put yourself back in that time period, 1984, and what was going on around the world at that time. There were a lot of dictators and people doing these kinds of things. And you have to imagine that those kinds of ideas were in the writers' heads when they were crafting Zarkon.
And the whole idea that they don't negotiate with terrorists.
Right, exactly. So I think it's kind of cool. You know, it is kind of silly to think that Zarkon would think that capturing five space explorers would mean that he has the ultimate checkmate to the Galaxy Alliance. But at the same time, we've seen people make crazier statements right here on Earth. So,
right. And for the first time, we say, "Hey, Witch Hagar," right?
Right.
And her first lines are, you know, "Beware, the Castle of Lions holds the secret of Voltron. Just hope no one discovers it. If she knows it's there..." Why hasn't she discovered it?
Right. Yeah, that is kind of an issue. And it's also funny that it's supposed to be this hidden place, but it's the first thing that the space explorers end up seeing when they come through the atmosphere the second time. But that's going to get into some fuzzy continuity, because I'll tell you that when I was watching it yesterday, and I was also watching Golion simultaneously, both of those shows in both versions have a lot of issues around the Castle of Lions and the time frame between Voltron's origin and we'll get into all of it. But what I'm saying is there's no explanation that Golion can offer up that Voltron cut out. They're both muddy on this point.
Right,
so.
Right. But I mean, when we were watching it back in 1984, and I can verify this, is that it seemed to go, you know, fine, and I didn't question, you know, what was going on, and you know, I was just a teenager at the time,
right?
But you know, there wasn't any reason for me to question that.
Sure.
So we get to the tower dungeon where the space explorers are being kept, and the other slaves are going to the arena because there's a big tournament that Zarkon's having, and the space explorers are supposed to be the main event.
Uh-huh.
So Lance, in all of his his wonderful snarkyism, he says, it'll be our final appearance, too.
Right.
I've got a great thing coming up on him, but they see the blue Robies for the first time, and you know he looks obviously menacing and everything, and then they pan to the people in the stands, and these are the Drool people, you know, and they all look alike except for their Alice in Wonderland costumes from the Mad Hatter's ball. They look like some kind of Royal Victorian costume ball participants, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, they're the upper echelon of Zarkon's society. They're probably the aristocracy, the sort of like the, you know, in Roman times they were the top of the food chain, and all they have to do now is go to the spa and go to the gladiator games.
Yeah, and Yurek he's you know pushing these prisoners through, and he's got this lightsaber type sword.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they only show it like once or twice, but it's pretty menacing. And they release the contestants to the arena. Then the Blue Robies comes out and pretty much easily defeats all of them.
Yeah, they're not really much of a threat. They're basically, in fact, some of them are drawn like Muppets.
Right, right. They were pretty useless.
Yeah,
and I'm sure things happened a little bit differently in the Beast Go Lion series.
In the Beast Go Lion, what you see is just absolute slaughter. It pulls no punches. It's yeah, these guys are scared. They're going to try and fight this thing off, and this thing isn't just going to knock them to the side. This thing rips their heads off. It crushes them like, you know, rotten fruit. It casts them to the ground where they're just, you know, limbs are everywhere, and it's pretty intense. But and just like with you pointed out, Urak's lightsaber weapon. You see him stab dying slaves with it right before he kicks everybody out into the arena to get killed by the beast man. Golion just heightens the violence and the intensity.
Right. So at this point, there's no other contestants that the Robies needs to fight. So Zarkon calls for the space explorers, and we see the space explorers in their dungeon cell. And they're showing each other their tattoos that were put on their arms by the prison guards. And it looks sort of like a skull with horns out the head and the jaw. And I'm not sure what those tattoos were supposed to represent other than that they were a prisoner on Planet Doom.
Yeah, I think that's the idea, is that they are just prisoners of this very megalomaniacal society. That symbol shows up in a few other places. Most notably, it shows up later on the crest of the doppelganger Voltron that they create on the desert world, and that's like a number of episodes later. But I think that's just Zarkon's skull crest, and it just says, "I own you. You're mine."
All right. So Keith says that you know, they need to get together and get their heads together to work on an escape plan. Pidge, he leaps high up to a window with bars on it, and this is the first time we ever get to see Pidge's actual acrobatic abilities, his ninja skills.
You're not far off, because in Go Lion, he actually says, "I'm descended from ninjas."
Right. Well, yeah. We didn't hear that at all in this one. We just saw him leap way up there. Lance is thinking at this point, you know, we're never going to make it. This is it. You know, Finny, final, we've had it, you know. And this reminds me of Bill Paxton's character in Aliens. That's it. Game over, man. Game over. I just keep on thinking
Lance,
about that.
Lance is the guy. He's like Bill Paxton in Aliens. That's a good way to put it. He's kind of like Private Kirby in the TV show Combat. He's the guy that says what everybody else is discreetly thinking, but he's the one that voices it out loud without shame.
Right. And then they show an angle of a shot, and this was a pretty cool thing, is that you're looking up to see them, all five of them, putting their hands together, united in their resolve to escape. And this is when Keith says the line, and I can't ever forget this line. We're space explorers, and we need space. I thought it was one of the best lines ever.
Yeah, it's certainly, depending on your sense of drama and your preferences, it can either be one where you just, you know, you pump your fist in the air, or it can be one where you wince uncontrollably. But I think it's a great line. It's a nice little twist on the whole thing. It gives some finality to that set piece, and then they move on to the next right. scene.
Well, at this point, we see the prison guard coming up to their cell, and he says, "Are the space explorers ready?" And he looks in, and he sees them all sleeping. He says, "No good. They sleep. Tell King Zarkon they'll fight better tomorrow." Can he really do that?
Apparently.
Everybody in the arena is waiting for the space explorers.
Well, in just to give you some perspective, in Goliath, they're not. They've already fought the Roe Beast and survived, and so now they're just waiting to see what happens to them next. And the reason that the guard comes by in that version is because they're trying to get out of that window up top, and they're making some noise. And Sven is by the door, and he's watching for the guards to come by, and he warns them. He says, "Hey, stop everything you're doing, and don't move, because the guard's coming by, and just look like you're asleep or whatever." And the guards just come by, look in, and then keep moving. But you're right, in Voltron the guards seem to have some brazen kind of attitude, where they're like, it doesn't matter what Zarkon says, we run the arena and we know our gladiators, and they're too tired to fight right now. So apparently they have some kind of cachet, or else they wouldn't take a risk.
At that point, the guard goes away, and Sven tells them it's okay. Coast is clear, and all of a sudden, Pidge has a rope. Where did the rope come from? Do all dungeon cells get ropes?
I guess it has more to do with the fact that we have to assume every prison cell in the galaxy has an old mattress somewhere,
okay,
where you can rip the shreds of cloth off and create a rope.
All right, so Pidge throws the rope up. He tosses up himself, and he ties a rope around one of the bars in the window. And then Hunk climbs up, and he bends the bars apart. But when he gets out to the other side, of course, there's a big drop down on the other side. And of course, Hunk is afraid of heights.
Yes. And that's actually the same between Goliath and Voltron. In Goliath, Hunk's name is Seydou. And Seydou is also afraid of heights. So
what they end up doing is they get down with the rope level by level, and when they get down to the bottom level, all of a sudden the vultures attack them, and they end up grabbing the legs of the vultures, and they eventually drop into a boneyard of skulls. Not exactly a soft landing, is it?
No. I actually amused myself a little bit when I saw their reaction. In Voltron, their reaction is very blunted compared to Goliath, because in Goliath, they actively realize they've just fallen into a pit of human remains, whereas in Voltron, they kind of pass it off a little bit.
Well, Keith says, "I hate to think of what this place means."
And, right.
and then he puts his hands together to pray for the departed souls.
Exactly.
So, and then, of course, Hunk just prays that they get out of there. So they run back towards the arena. And they find a vent to climb through, and they're looking for the slave ship that brought them there.
Right. And that's when we get to see them, and one of my favorite scenes in really the whole series, is we finally get to see them in hand-to-hand combat
with
some of the soldiers.
Yeah, they're actually fighting their way through to the ship to prepare to take off. So that whole way there, they have to fight off a whole bunch of people, and we see what they can actually do, you know, with those skills that they learned.
Right. And that's why you realize it's probably a smart move on the part of Galaxy Garrison to assume that they'll be able to take care of themselves.
And it's at this point when they get in the ship and they start to take off and everything that we hear John Peterson's score in its first, they're really going to escape. You know, this is what it means. You know, they're that heroic score that John Peterson made for this show. So it's not Voltron coming together, but hey, you know, it's the space explorers escaping. And as they leave, they knock off one of the pointy towers of Castle Doom and say, hey, let's kiss Zarkon goodbye, right?
Right. And which, you know, that's a wise use of resources on the way out, truly. It's like, you know what, while we're here, as we're passing by, we might as well clothesline the palace. Let's just go ahead and do that.
Clothesline. All right, so at this point, Zarkon's talking, and he finally mentions Urak. We get to hear Urak's name for the first time, and he tells him the space explorers stole their prison ship, and Zarkon tells him, go after them and don't come back without them. Urak, of course, says the prison ship is slow, so we should be able to overtake them.
Right, and this is the moment where you start to realize that they really see these space explorers as a threat. You know, that they're not just five worthless nobodies from another world that you saw get slaughtered in the arena. These five are of particular interest to Zarkon, and the last thing he wants is for them to be scot-free.
So, as Urak said, the prison ship is slow, so he does overtake them pretty quickly, and their first shot is a laser shot direct in the rear, and it really shakes them up. And then Urak says, open up with everything we've got, and it pretty much tears the ship apart. And it looks like they're in the middle of a space storm as this whole thing is happening, as there's like thunder and lightning and everything happening. And the ship spirals out of control.
And that's just a comment on the shoddy workmanship of Zarkon's spaceship mechanics. They really don't build anything to last. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, you're right, though. It was a very exciting scene to watch when we were kids. I mean, you're sitting there watching these heroes that you've only just barely gotten to know. You've seen them do some amazing things under some extreme duress, and it seems like they're never going to get a break. It's like, how are they going to land this safely? How are they going to get out of this?
For some reason, they're able to, sort of like spiral out of control, but right towards Aris. Mm-hmm. And there's a tractor beam that comes out from the Castle of Lions, from the statue that's out in front of the Castle of Lions, and it's a tractor beam that pulls them towards the planet.
Right.
And it's here that that Keith first tells the story of the Voltron legend, and this is pretty important to the whole story, so I thought I'd play that scene. Is that okay?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, here we go.
And according to the legends, Voltron was the most powerful defender of justice in the far universe. He was invincible. Voltron was terrific. He put those evil robots out of business for good. But Zarkon had one last trick up his sleeve. He's got this witch, Hagar, and she disguised herself as a beautiful goddess and went up into space. When Voltron came nearer, she placed a curse on him. But she couldn't destroy him completely. The old witch broke Voltron up into five parts. Each part a robot lion. If we could discover the secret of the lions, we could bring those five lions out of their hidden dens. They'd all come together and attach somehow, just like the legend says. Two would make the legs, two the arms and body, and one lion would become the robot's head. Then we'd have Voltron Defender of the Universe to help us, and to help the people of Eris fight the evil Zarkon.
All right, so there you have it. The Legend of Voltron, spoken by Keith.
You can see why it was so exciting for, you know, a kid or a young teenager. I mean, it's for its time, it was really compelling, and I think it's archetypal. It's just got all the elements of you know, mystery and magic and epic heroism. It's a really, really cool origin story. One of the things that I do want to add about it is that it is one of the larger departures from the source material. In Golion, the space explorers are coming back to Earth, as I said. They don't even know the planet at all, the planet Eris. They escape from Zarkon's homeworld, and they are headed towards this world to try and crash land. They're brought in by the tractor beam of this lion statue, and they're not even aware of Golion's existence. They don't know anything about it. They don't know anything about a castle, nothing. They're just trying to get away from these crazy people that are trying to, you know, churn them into stew for these beast people. And so Voltron and Golion have these very distinct identities, and I think that's a very good thing, because Voltron has more of that heroic bend where they're searching for this thing. That's why they were headed there to find, you know, that they say it in the intro. They're there to find Voltron and resurrect it to, you know, save the galaxy.
Right.
And that in of itself has its own mysticism. It's like looking for Excalibur. So.
Right. And as the first episode ends, they say, can they discover the secret of Voltron in time? And then they show the teaser for scenes from the next Voltron episode, which was really cool. And at this point, I'm glad that we got to see Voltron, at least in that first episode, even if it was in a legend tale and not in reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that was well planned on their part, because they knew that you can't have a show called Voltron and then the first episode you don't really see anything. The television show Golion gets around that because it tells the origin story of Golion in the first episode before the action really gets going.
Right.
And so in that sense, you're already familiar with the robot. So yeah, I think it was really smart on their part to do that at the end of the show.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
And now we're into episode 2, Escape to Another Planet.
Cool.
So at the beginning of this, it's still in that part where the ship is falling apart and crash landing on planet Eris. So they, even though they got caught in that tractor beam and everything, the beam isn't gently floating them down like you might think it would. They're still going to crash land.
Yeah, it's just almost like a guidepost. It's like, hey, right, try and crash this way. Don't right, crash that way.
Right. So at this point, they're going to have to eject. And this whole eject sequence, okay, this is where you really get to learn the acrobatic abilities of these five space explorers.
Or lack of.
Yeah, well, the seats that they're sitting in, when they eject and they're spinning. I would have thrown up, okay? This would have been like the worst amusement park ride ever. Because at the force that they were spinning, there's no way I would have been able to withstand that force. But, you know, somehow Pidge lands on his feet perfectly.
He's descended from ninjas, man. That's how he's got that center of gravity.
Of course, Hunk lands face first and his feet are sticking up in the air. And when they finally get him uncovered and you know, they start thinking about what they should do, Hunk's first thought is food.
Right. And that actually is the moment that provides me with what is my favorite Pidge line in the whole 70 episode series of Voltron, where he pulls him out of the dirt and he's like, your face is disgusting. And I'm like, ah, ha, ha, that's awesome.
They start thinking about what they should be doing. And of course they all think, well, we need to head towards that castle of lions. And it's at that point that they see that there's a cave nearby. They start thinking about going that way, but all of a sudden the locals are firing arrows and spears at them.
Yeah, because they don't know who they are. I mean, they, for all they know, those are Zarkon spies.
Right.
It's like, hey, you just totally decimated our planet. We're not taking any chances. If you're a stranger, you're meat. Like, there's no middle ground.
So amazingly, they don't get hit by any of the arrows or spears. But they're thinking about throwing some of them back, but they're saying, no, we're supposed to be here to help these people. And Hunk is like, what are you, crazy? They're trying to kill us. And then, Lance says something like, well, they've been through a nightmare. And Hunk is like, well, how do you help someone who doesn't help themselves? And it's not easy, So they have to find a way to help each other. They have to help the people of Arrus, and then the people of Arrus have to, learn to trust them, sort of.
Well, this is where I have to tell you. First of all, that is really the message point of the entire Voltron series, summed up right there in that conversation that they have. They're there to, rebound the people of Arrus and give them hope and give them something to live for, and remind them that not everybody outside their world is evil, and that there are people that can help them. And it's a great moment in the series. In Golion, that conversation is completely comedic, and in the first half. And in the second half, it's just dry humor morose. It starts out with, Hunk saying, or Seydou, who is Hunk, saying, why are they trying to attack us? And then this is something that Lance fans, I think, will like, who haven't seen Golion, because everybody loves Lance's attitude. In that version, he says, well, you know why they're attacking you. I'm paraphrasing. He says, you know why they're attacking you, right? And he's like, no. And he says, he goes, they're probably hungry. He goes, there's nothing on this. And then Hunk is like, you mean they're cannibals? Lance doesn't really know, and he's like, oh, something like that. I don't know. And so he freaks Hunk out. And then they look off into the desert, just like they do in the Voltron. But instead of talking about how they're going to help the people and all that kind of stuff, they start asking themselves, well, what kind of world are we on? And then somebody says, we must be in hell. And then the other guy says, he says, well, I don't know. From the looks of this planet, I'd rather be in hell. Like, it's just this whole assessment of what predicament they're in. So it's very
Right.
interesting to see the way the two shows handle the same imagery.
Well, I'd have to agree with Hunk. I'd probably be looking for food at that point, and I don't know, what I'd be doing. I'd have to assume that it's not a safe bet to go towards where the people were throwing spears at them, so they went the other way towards the castle. And they found themselves in a muck of fog, which, has its benefits too, because they were being hidden from Urak's forces, which were looking for them. So thank God for the fog, huh?
The fog was a happy accident. That was that was a good thing, because with the coverage that Zarkon's air fleet has, if they've been caught out in the open, as you see from some of the footage later, when they're just canvassing the desert, there's no escape. I mean, if there hadn't been fog, there wouldn't have been a third episode.
Right.
would have ended halfway through.
Right. So they finally get to the castle, and they hear the lions roar, and the gate lowers, and they go in. And the castle still looks pretty badly damaged from the attacks that Ares took. And Pidge Mines manages to get up towards the top, and he sees the space mice for the first time. Now, this is actually sort of like the second time we saw them, because the first time we saw them, they were running away from the initial attack. But that was really quick. This time we actually see them up close. Space mice are going to be a big part of the show, aren't they?
Yeah, they're going to get their own vehicle later, and
Yeah.
but in the you're talking about for this mini series, yes, they're pivotal to this story because they are the linchpin of putting Voltron back together.
Right. Now, Keith gets inside, the big door opens, they go in. And then the door closes behind them, and they're starting to get worried. What do we do now? What do we do? And then all of a sudden they meet Koran. Koran is the castle diplomat, and right now at this point he doesn't trust anybody, and he's the keeper of the ruins, and he's trying to protect everything there. So,
right. And you know, just to expand on that point a little bit with Coran, is that he's called a diplomat in Voltron, which I think is a much better label for him than in the source material. In the original, they call him the castle strategist. And if you think Coran is distrustful in the beginning of anybody who shows up, Rabel is outright hostile. Rabel is his name in Golion, but Coran in Golion is outright hostile. I mean, he actually attacks them at one point right there in the foyer of the castle. I actually much prefer Coran in Voltron. I think it's much more I can accept it more organically than his characterization in the source.
Well, they at one point ask him if he's a scientist.
Right.
You know, and he tells him, no, I'm just the castle diplomat, and right now I'm the keeper of these ruins.
Right.
So they explain to him that Zarkon knows they're there and he's coming after them, so they really need to act quick to try to find this whole secret of Voltron. Mm-hmm. And Coran introduces them to Princess Allura for the first time.
Yeah, it's a lot of sparkles and some really nice animation, and it's a very memorable scene. You know,
she makes quite an entrance, doesn't she?
She does. She does. She puts Disney princesses almost to shame.
Yeah, and Pidge he's floored. She's beautiful. He can't even help himself. He's not even thinking inside his own mind. He's saying it outwardly. Wow, she's beautiful.
Yeah, you know he's. And he's right.
So Allura mentions that her father, Alfor, was the one that knew how to activate Voltron. And now that he's gone, they don't know the secret. So Coran tells him how each lion buried itself in a different part of the planet as it landed. And they don't have King Alfor to know how to form Voltron. The space explorers tell him that look, we're what you got, you know, we're willing to fight with our own bare hands and everything, so let's go do this, you know. And Coran finally says, all right, well, you know, you guys are going to be our protectors then. From this moment on, you five will be known as the Voltron Force.
Right.
And that's the first time we hear this.
Yeah,
the very first time we hear Voltron Force.
I would kill to get a promotion like that in real life. That, yeah. That surprisingly, just wait! I'm now a hero of your world. What did I do to earn this? Sweet, you know. Showed up at the castle at the right time.
We're halfway into the second episode. They go from being space explorers to the Voltron Force.
Uh huh.
And the very next scene, King Zarkon tells everybody, "Find the Voltron Force and capture them immediately." How did he know?
Oh gosh,
maybe it was just. No, they got that promotion.
I have a feeling that you know, if you're asking me seriously, I have a feeling that just had to do with the writer of the script was in a flow, and he was just, or he or she was just going to town on the typewriter, and they had just written the words Voltron Force in the last scene, and they didn't think about it. And they just rolled right into the next scene and used the words Voltron Force. I'm sure if they'd given it some thought, they would have said Space Explorers again or something. But, right. You know, right. Zarkon is aware of the threat of Voltron. I mean, he attacked Eris and couldn't find it or whatever. And, you know, so he knows it's laying in wait for him.
Right. So as a result of them getting, you know, to be the Voltron Force, Coran shows them the control room.
Right.
And Hunk's great line right here. Well, be nice if we had something to control.
Yeah. This brings up a good point, Mark. And I was wondering what you thought about this. Okay. So in The Legend of Voltron, they say that, you know, Hagar tricked Voltron into thinking that it was the space goddess or whatever, and then it broke it up into five parts. How far in the past was that? Because it landed back on Eris And when you see the footage of it landing, you do see the castle in the background. So you know that somebody is in residence on this planet at this point. It's not like it happened in prehistoric times with dinosaurs roaming the Earth or whatever. So right. it lands, right? Okay, well, now at this point, we don't know. Based on what he says in the myth, we have to assume that Voltron, up until that point, had never been separated into five parts. She tries to destroy him, but only succeeds in breaking him into five parts. So, that being said, and I don't mean to get too deep into this, but how much time do you think passed between that first curse from Hagar and the five lions crashing to the ground and King Alphor dying? The reason that I ask this is because somehow, even though there's an indication that those lions may have never seen service as lions, he has keys, he's got a control room, he's got uniforms. I mean, he was pretty dang prepared.
If they're remarking about how King Alphor knew how to form Voltron, and they're talking about how, you know, it seemed like to me it had been done before since he had broken up into the five lions.
Right, right, okay.
So I would assume that there's not very much time between the time that he was broken up into the five lions and they all got their dens on Eris. And at some point, King Alphor probably had to use Voltron to protect Eris at some point. Now, I don't know what happened that all of a sudden, you know, King Alphor's dead and, you know, nobody knows how to do this now. So at some point you would think that there was a part where Voltron failed, or they weren't able to get the lines together quickly enough to get something to happen. So no one really knows, you know what you're asking there. No one really knows what happened to King Alphor.
Well, and I'll just add this very briefly, is that the problem remains the same in Goliant. In Goliant, it's equally vague how long it is between Voltron being split into five parts and the rise of the Kingdom of Eris. So we don't really know, you know, how somebody was able to figure out that these lions could be formed, stuff like that. We take it on myth, we enjoy it, and we move on. But I wanted to ask you about that in the Voltron context, because I was noticing that similarity between the two. It's like, my gosh, these timelines are very tight. How does this work? So,
and we see for the first time that the Voltron force gets their uniforms.
Yes.
And a couple of the guys are mentioning how, you know, I don't really need to wear a uniform or anything, but then Pidge says, well, if it pleases the princess, suit up.
Yeah, in Goliant, there's a great self-referential line in that scene where it's Sven, and in that show, his name is Shiragane, and he says, when they hand him the uniforms, he says, "You guys are way too well prepared for all this." like, how did you know we were gonna, you know, get here, and how did you know that to have uniforms ready, and what's going on here? It's pretty funny.
Karan shows him that, you know, there were underground tunnels going from the control room to the lions and everything, but they don't know how to do them, and they don't know where, you know. At this point, they're not even mentioning keys yet.
Right.
So we don't even know at this point that there's keys involved. Of course, the very next episode, it's called A Ghost in Four Keys.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
So, episode 3, A Ghost in Four Keys. We start off again, this time with Zarkon. And Zarkon's asking Hagar. Hagar tells him that the five space explorers landed safely, and that she mentions they might find out what the secret of Voltron is. And he says, "Voltron, you told me you destroyed him." He says, "They must be found and destroyed." And what he does is he gets a robot beast from the arena, and that one is sent to Eris. Now, this isn't the same Robeast that initially fought all the people in the arena right before the space explorers were supposed to, but this is a different one. And we see for the first time the deadly beast craft, the coffin ship, basically.
Right.
So what did you? What was your first impressions when you saw that the Robeast was going to travel in this ship that looked like a coffin?
I can tell you that this is the argument that I've had with so many other members of my generation, you know, for 20 years, who are bigger fans of Transformers and G.I. Joe or even He-Man. You know, they always seem to say, oh, Voltron was this thing and I wasn't all that into it. Well, Voltron was my favorite cartoon growing up. It was my favorite character, you know. And I always throw back on them a few examples from that show of what made it much edgier, much more mature and hardcore than anything they liked. You know, Optimus Prime can take a walk, because the Voltron mythos with those skull-laden, almost like bone-webbed coffins coming down out of these evil-looking spaceships that look like they were made by the aliens from the movie Alien, and then landing, opening up, and then there's this, you know, dark, demonic kind of like resurrection type thing as this beast comes growing out of this coffin. That, you know, they were all designed differently, but they all just looked very scary and just, you know, very hideous and just dangerous. And I always tell people, you know, there's nothing in any of the other shows that were popular in the 80s that came close to this. I mean, not even
Skeletor from He-Man.
Right. And he was purely comedic. I mean, in a good way. I laugh at Skeletor even now as an adult. And I laugh with him. Like, he's funnier to me now than he was then. But Voltron really had the edge. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't remember. That show had a lot of stuff that you look at it now and you go, you set it up next to G.I. Joe and Transformers and He-Man cartoons and you go, man, I can't believe they showed this in the 80s. You know, this is some serious stuff.
Well, I got to tell you, back then, the only thing I thought that would come out of a coffin was Dracula.
Right.
You know, when it comes to monsters and stuff like that, the only thing coffin related was Dracula to me. So I thought it was going to be a vampire. You know, that was my first thought.
Right.
And we find out later, and we'll talk about this later when they really show a good segment about how, you know, this beast comes out of the coffin and rises into the height that it rises to. But we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's at this point that Commander Yorak, he's not happy that the Robeast is coming out. He doesn't need Robeast help. You know, he wants to have these five space explorers, the Voltron Force, and he thinks, you know, he's not going to have any problem getting them, although he's had his problems up until now, hasn't he?
Yeah, unfortunately, Yorak, his is a sad lot in life. He's always destined to play second fiddle. He can't ever seem to really – his luck is never in his favor. And, you know, obviously we're going to see that long after the episodes we're talking about, when Prince Lotor shows up and takes his place and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, Yorak, he means well, and he probably he probably deserves that promotion just for sheer tenacity. But he just doesn't have luck on his side.
Right. And so Commander Yorak deploys his ground forces and some snakes. I never understood that part where they actually showed snakes coming out on the ground and everything.
Well, I can explain that through Golion. In Golion,
all right, what happened?
In Golion, the snakes are actually native to the planet. And you hear... Sadak is his name. Yorak's name in Golion is Sadak, and he says, you know, we're gonna find those space explorers or something like that. He's like, they're not gonna get away from us. Shoot anything that moves. And the snakes pop up out of the sand, and they're instantly just vaporized by the soldiers who are marching through the desert. So clearly, in the editing of Voltron, they just made the snakes look like tagalongs to the army. But in Golion, they're they're life forms of Eris. So
all right, so in the control room, the Voltron force is positioned to act. So they say we need to get to the Lions. How do we activate the Lions? And then Karan mentions that in order to activate the Lions, you need the keys. And he says they were placed in Alfor's tomb. So at this point, Pidge is like, well, but we got to stop these forces. All right, if we can't get the Lions out, then we need to go ourselves. And he goes out and he's ready to take on the whole army himself.
And don't you love the huge continuity error in the animation on that scene? Have you ever noticed? How Pidge is in his Western wear, as I like to call it. He's in his fringy street clothes inside the control room, and he runs off and then instantly runs outside the castle, and he's in his Voltron pilot's outfit. Like,
right.
Yeah.
So at this point, the other people are like, hey, Pidge, don't go. And then he goes, and then they can't stop him. Well, what are we going to do to help him? Well, let's go get the Lions. So let's get those keys. So Allura goes with them, and even though Karan, you know, warns her this isn't going to be pretty, it's like, well, this is where I get my strength from. My father gave me my strength, so I want to go down there with you. As they're going down, they're following a route. There's like an elevator that takes them down to the tomb, and they remark about the modern technology inside of this old castle. And of course, yeah, from the outside, it looks like just like an old castle. But from the inside, this thing is really built up with a lot of modern technology.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, it reminds me a lot of Forbidden Planet, the old 50s sci-fi movie where they're down on the planet, and they meet the scientist and his daughter on this very humble looking home that's like little lab home that he has, and then he takes them into his real laboratory, which is, you know, through this secret compartment in a wall, and suddenly there's this vast futuristic technological underground, and they're all marveling at, you know, all the wonders that he's created just beyond the walls. And you know, the Castle of Lions is the same way. It's always deceptive to the eye. You don't really know what you're looking at in the castle. It's a technological marvel disguised as a pre-Arthurian ruin.
Right. But at least it gives you some inkling of what, you know, secrets could be hidden inside this castle.
Yes. Yes.
So they get to Alfor's tomb, and immediately they see an image, and Alfor's voice comes out of this image and appears before them, and he says that with the help of these strangers, they can help fight against Zarkon and restore Eris. And he says, the keys are with me. So then he disappears, knowing that, you know, things are going to be all right because the Voltron force is there.
Yeah, he's putting a lot of faith in them, and rightfully so. You know, they turn out to be, you know, very competent and selfless. It's kind of funny to me, though, that Alfor isn't aware of the problem at hand that we're about to discover.
Right, and the problem, of course, is that when the tomb opens up, they see four keys and not five. The fifth one is missing.
Right.
The main lion key is gone.
And yet,
who could have taken it?
Yes, and yet those mice that we know understand English are watching from above and do nothing. they just run off. Like, hope they don't find out.
Well, you know, nobody really knows it's the mice that has it at this point, right?
Right, but the mice know what they're looking for when the mice are looking down through the crack in the wall. And they're right. Like, they hear the whole conversation. That mouse, if you watch the show, you know, as you did, he looks like kind of guilty, like, oh, yeah, crap. I'm going to go have lunch now. You know, I hope they don't see me.
So. Yeah. So we go back to Pidge holding his own against the whole army, you know, with one laser pistol and his ninja reflexes. and we see some reused scenes from episode one here, don't we?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, which was indicative of the whole series. I mean, they had to reuse a lot of these scenes, just, you know, otherwise they would have had to redo some animations and stuff. But when you're taking all this from, you know, the Japanese animation and everything, and they want to show some scenes of some more battles that weren't actually there, they have to make them up.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was a clever workaround, and I think they did a really good job with what they had. I certainly didn't complain when I was 7. So.
Right. I was completely fine with it. And besides that, it was almost every 80s show that I saw where they were reusing scenes over and over again. I mean, I remember seeing like the A-Team, or, you know, Greatest American Hero, or, you know, I don't know, the $6 Million Man and stuff like that. There were so many scenes. Haven't I seen this before? Yeah, I have seen this before.
I never questioned it. You know, there's a number of people that criticize Masters of the Universe for the constant reuse of what they called stock animation. And I said, well, that was because Masters of the Universe, the company that made it, Filmation, they had to prove that they could create 65 original episodes for syndication a season. And so what they did was they determined how much a percentage of each show had to be stock and how much had to be animated new. And it never bothered me because it was high quality. So,
So getting back to the story, Pidge is holding his own, but he's getting worried. So he calls the team for support, and we find out that his little phone thing is right on his belt, which is pretty cool. And he's calling them for help, and they're like, are you okay? Do you need our help? And he's like, this ain't a social call.
Yeah, they had some good lines back then, some good witticisms and some dry humor. I always enjoyed it.
So they actually have to convince Karan, hey, let's go in these ships. How do we get into these ships and everything? And Karan eventually, you know, gives in and says, well, each of you are going to have to ride an elevator to a lion. So they jump through the doorways, the numbered doorways, for the first time. And we see them zip line to their cockpits and take to their lions. The keys activate the lions and they yell, go lions.
Right. Which is a reference to the original show. Go lion.
Right.
Yep.
Right. I thought that was pretty cool that they did that.
Yep. It's a nice little salute to the original show. I've often wondered, though, with the number of times they had to run to the lions and not having a real elevator, just having that zip line, what are the odds? I wouldn't have any confidence in myself that I would be able to do that successfully every time. Like, because they leap onto those zip line handles. It's like,
yes.
I am going to miscalculate this one day. I'm going to mess this up and I'm going to go plummeting to my death.
it would be like Batman and Robin jumping on the bat poles and completely missing them.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So Pidge is close to getting captured and the locals save him and bring him back into the caves, and the lions appear. And they are fighting Urak, and they start busting apart Urak's ground ships. And they use rockets and lasers that shoot from the lions, and we see that for the first time. What do you think?
I think that that was a necessary scene because it shows how formidable Zarkon's forces are. I mean, I want to see stakes in a battle between the bad guys and the good guys. I don't want it to seem like the good guys always have this massive weapon with the upper hand all the time. And I also don't want my bad guys to constantly be doing things that aren't really all that threatening. I like seeing bad guys do things that raise the temperature in the room a little bit, you know, get the blood pressure going. I thought it was very effective.
Right. Me too. They did so well against the ground forces that they go after Urak's ship. And that's when the Robeast appears.
Right.
And this is where we, you know, Hagar says her Robeast is better than all of Urak's forces. And when you see the Robeast break from his coffin and grow into this huge robot, you actually believe her.
Right. I think it was probably the coolest moment in that episode, because you've seen these lions successfully fend off these enemy forces, tanks and fighters, and they've used every weapon at their disposal to destroy these enemies. And they've been, you know, it's essentially, even though they're these awesome lions, they are outnumbered, you know, 10-1. But they've been able to repel this whole force. And they think to themselves, even though we can't form Voltron, even though we've only got 4 out of 5 lions, we are kicking tail. And then suddenly it's like, oh, right, checkmate. And then this huge roe beast pops up and it's like, now what are you going to do? Because we weren't done yet.
And what they decide to do is let's attack from 4 sides. And the roe beast just completely lays them out and they're knocked out cold.
Right.
And that's the end.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool ending cliffhanger.
Yeah, I mean, it shows that not every episode ends well.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
Episode 4, The Missing Key. So now we're at Hagar telling Zarkon that they only have the 4 keys and they can't form Voltron yet. And what she's going to do is boost the power of the Roe Beast. And somehow the Voltron force has vanished. Nobody knows where they are. So at this point, the locals are showing Pidge to the castle through the underground tunnels. And a large rock wall opens up to an area below the castle. And then Pidge sees the space mice again, and he gets back to the control room.
Right, and if you watch that scene closely, I just got to tell you, if you watch that scene closely, you'll notice a weird continuity error. It's like between like 4 different shots, Pidge inexplicably goes from his pilot uniform to his casual clothes like 3 times between the different shots. It's pretty funny.
So Pidge asks, where's the rest of the force? And Princess Allura and Karan say, I don't know. We don't know where they are. We hope they're okay and everything, but they fear the worst. And then they hear Hunk snoring over the comm from the control room.
Right.
And Pidge knows they're okay, and he's just jumping like excitedness that anybody's alive. And Pidge calls them all back to the control room, and he just doesn't know whether to laugh or cry.
Well, you can imagine if you're the only one of your friends that you think is left still alive, and you realize that the enemy's gunning for you, they've possibly killed your friends, you don't really know anybody else that's around you right now, and now you really can't form Voltron for a multitude of reasons, you're probably going to be pretty depressed.
Yeah. So
to find out your friends are alive after that, I would be ecstatic.
So he gets a little bit playful with them. He hides up at the top of the control tower, and they're looking around for him, and he jumps on top of them.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah, it was a lighthearted moment in the midst of all this turmoil. So
yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's Pidge is that character that serves that purpose. He keeps things lighter for everybody because he's still got that youthful vigor.
Right.
I mean, Lance to a certain degree. And sometimes when Pidge and Hunk pair up and do their little antics, but it's always Pidge that's the catalyst for the humor.
Yeah. So Sven breaks the humor and he asks if they found that 5th key yet. And what they end up doing is they end up searching the whole castle twice. And then they say, well, why don't we go back to the tomb and see if there was anything around there? And then Hunk sees a hole in the wall. And then Pidge sees the space mice, and they say maybe they hid the key. So Pidge shows them where the space mice live, and Hunk traps them.
Right.
And of course, Allura's not happy about this.
Mm-hmm.
She tells him the story about how the space mice have always been her friend, and as an only child in the castle, they amused her. You know, they danced for her and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they... You know, and of course we won't go into how does Allura have a niece if she's an only child at this point, right?
Right, exactly.
Right, we're not going to talk about Larmina at this point, right?
No. Let us not invoke that name right now. And it's important to note, Pidge's relationship with the mice in this series of episodes in Golion is completely adversarial. In Voltron, it's just kind of neutral. You know, he quips at him a little bit, asks him if they have a cheese sandwich, runs off, comes back, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. In Galion, he initially does not like these mice. When he runs off to fight the Zarkon's forces while he leaves everybody behind in the castle, he doesn't say got a cheese sandwich. He says, stick around and I'll come back later and maybe I'll have you for a snack or something like that. Like, he says he's going to eat them.
Wow.
So yeah, so when he figures out that it's the mice that might have this key, he's hellbent on getting them to, you know, reveal what they know. So
to me, in Voltron, it seems like he almost has the second best relationship with the mice behind Allura. And Hunk is the one that really doesn't like the mice at all.
Right. And to your point, very quickly after the original four episodes in Galion, Pidge in that show, his name is Suzushi. He bonds with the mice very, very quickly. But in the opening few episodes, it's not so hunky dory with him and the mice. He's kind of antagonizes them a little bit. So
okay,
yeah.
All right. Well, looks like we've come to an end of another great Let's Voltron podcast. At this point, we would like to thank everyone for submitting your ideas for Challenge the Chi. After Chi Toy has finished working with this image, we will go to another round of Challenge the Chi probably the next time. And at this point, we would like to say thank you for listening to us and talking about the first four episodes of Voltron. This is an important part of the whole history of Voltron in the 30 years that Voltron has been around, because this was the thing that led up to Voltron being formed for the first time, which is something that just everybody loves every episode that it happens. So we're thankful to be able to bring these space explorers turned Voltron Force members to you in one episode of the Let's Voltron podcast. So thank you very much, Mike, for giving us the thoughts about Beast Golion and how it interacted with the regular Voltron that we've come to love all these years.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. It's really hard to believe it's been 30 years since we first saw these episodes. It makes you feel young and at the same time old. It's weird, but
yeah.
But I never stop enjoying this show. Especially these four episodes, they get better and better every time you watch them. So it's always a pleasure talking about them. So,
well, I have shown these episodes to my son, and he likes them too. And he has seen the original Voltron Force before he actually saw these episodes.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so he already had a perspective of Voltron even before this happened. So he was looking at it now through my eyes, through what I had seen the first time. So that was kind of special.
That's very interesting. I'm curious to know what he thought of it.
Oh, he likes it. But I think he still likes Voltron Force better.
It's that slicker animation. That's yeah. What's got him hooked. So more gadgets to play with. So,
right.
Yeah. Well, you can just josh him by telling him that he didn't have any toys for his. So.
At the same time, it's a little bit of blissful and a little bit of sad.
Yes, that's
to
true.
Say that.
We got to take what we can get with these young whippersnappers.
Right. All right. Well. Thank you again, and as everyone knows, we always end the show this way. Let's Voltron!